Hein?
Ouais.
Thanks. As was announced by the previous speaker, the subject of our lecture today is in the form of question, can man know God? If you look at this question carefully, we realize that in the question there is an assumption that there is God. At least as regards his great existence, there is no dispute. The only question is, can man really know God? And as was pointed out by the previous speaker, our idea of God is what is going to determine what is the answer to this particular question. And what is our idea of God? Our idea of God is typically in terms of what we have understood from our own religion in which we are born. And there are monotheistic religions, Christianity, Judaism, Islam, they talk about one God. And there are polytheistic religions which talk about multiplicity of God. And yet, there are other religions which talk about one reality existing behind the multiplicity of God. So, we realize that the answer to the question, can man know God, depends a lot on what is our idea of God. Now, some people, as already announced by the previous speaker, have an idea of God in which they say that God is a gigantic being. It is kind, merciful, loving, good, just. It is omnipresent, omnipotent, omniscient. This is their idea of God. But little reflection will show us that if this God is a person, however mighty he may be, he must be there, present, contained in space. And that would make space to be mightier than this God is here. Space is containing this finite God. So, this is the idea which tells us very clearly that in that case, God cannot be only present. Space is mightier. And also, the next question will arise in our mind as to who created this God? From where came the space? And who created the matter for the manifestation of the world? And it is, you can say, it's a question of infinite regress in which we will not be able to arrive at any final answer. Also, if we say that God is kind, merciful, good, then why is it that there is so much evil in the world? Evil is very much prevalent in our today's time. And people, again, they have that theory, they say that evil has come from devil. It is the work of devil. Now, if evil is the work of devil, obviously he is also a mighty being who is able to stand against God, destroy his works, and spread terror, which is very evident in the world. Again, we come to conclusion that therefore again the God cannot be omnipresent. He is not there in this person called devil. And this devil has the power to destroy the work of God. In which case, how can that God be omnipotent, all-powerful? If he was all-powerful, he would have simply destroyed that devil. But it is not the case. We continue to see evil in the world. So, the personal idea of God is again questioning how personal God is omnipresent, or omnipresent, omnipotent. And we say that God is creating, some religions talk about this, that God creates a new soul for every baby that is born. Now, if that is the case, then one Buddhist priest argued that if that is the case, then obviously he must be an accomplice in crime where babies are bond of identity. Krishna says that identity is time. And God is creating even that soul. So he is at upper peace in the time. And the Christian party had no answer and suddenly found that time was too short and was just created the question and went away. Also, he says that God creates a new soul for every baby that is born. And if this God is just, then how is it that some babies are born in a very, very favorable circumstances, with rich parents, a nice, healthy body, very fine intellect, whereas there are others who are born to poor parents, deformed body, congenital diseases, and in such abject misery that one wonders where is the justice of God in creating this baby with so much of pain and misery, which it has not deserved at all. Also, people say that some religions, particularly Calvinistic, they say that we should not be questioning the wisdom of God. And it is the will of God. And God has already preordained some people to go to heaven. And rest of them, not his favored people, are preordained to go to hell, no matter what they do. Now, this is a terrible idea, because this God, this sort of idea of God, makes him nothing less than a despot, a tyrant, a person who is running the affairs of the world as he pleases. Where is the sense of justice? We say God is just. Where is the sense of justice? Creating baby with deformity for no fault of their own, punishing people to eternal hell for crimes committed for one lifetime, or having some favored people to go to eternal heaven. Others are going to hell for no fault of their own. This idea says that this God is even, his sense of justice is even inferior to that of an ordinary man who would not punish a person without some reason. And he would not give a punishment which is more than the crime that is committed. And some people also say that we would like to pray to this God, because God then grants us all our desires, he helps us. Then HP says something very important. He says that, you know, on the one hand are saying that God is omniscient, then is it not a blasphemy to say that God requires your utter prayers to know what is needed for you? Also, people pray that give us our daily bread, deliver us from sin, lead us not into temptation. This sort of again prayer is, if you rely on someone outside, you will never become self-dependent. You will always depend on someone outside of you. It will make you more selfish. Also, if you say that God, when I pray to God, I get some strength to overcome my weaknesses, then HP says that if the strength is coming because you pray to God, then where is your merit in overcoming your weaknesses? God has given you strength to overcome your weaknesses. Why you should be rewarded for something which has cost you nothing but just a prayer? And also, if that is the idea, then she said that, just think, would you pray to a laborer who is working in your farm, whole day's wage, if whole day he sat under an apple tree, prayed to you, and while you did all his hard work, would you pay him a full day's wage? This is a sort of idea of moral idleness. It is beneath human dignity, and it is very, very revolting. And also some people say that if you pray to God, no matter what sins we are committed, he will forgive us. He is very kind, he will forgive us. Also, Jesus has already shed his blood, kind of paid the price of his sins, for the sins committed by, which will be committed by people. And so, you just have to believe with the blood of Christ, all your sins will be wiped out. Isn't it absurd? When the person who confesses to God and says, forgive me, and continues to live his life, rest of the life, in the same poor, sinful manner, how can a God forgive this man? Also, if he says that he has committed a crime, maybe a murder, and his family members are suffering because the bread earner has gone, or maybe some crime in which the victim for life continues to suffer. If this is the case, then how can a third person called God forgive this man for his crime when he doesn't even mend his way? If at all anyone has got right to forgive, which we should, if at all anyone has got right to forgive, it is the person who has been wrong, it is the person who has been a victim of the crime. So these are the kind of reading out the negative idea of God in order to understand what is the nature of God. Now, theosophy tells us that God is not a person. It is not a gigantic being. Rather, it is one absolute principle, which is also called as Parabrahma in Hindu philosophy. It is one absolute reality which always exists, which is all pervasive, pervasive, without beginning or an end, and therefore it is rootless root and causeless cause of everything, about which you cannot ask the question who created it. It has always existed. And we are told that it is without any attribute. You can't say it is kind, just, merciful. Then you will be removing all the negatives. It is the all-containing one reality. And we are told that it is not a person, it's not a being. Rather, you can say it is beingness. It's very difficult to understand this sort of idea of God. Our mind reads, so we try to think of this nature of God. And so, HPP tells us to try to take what's involved. You can say that God is like absolute abstract space. Space, you know, is all the time there, unaffected, whether the solar system comes into presence. They are destroyed. Sun comes, sun vanishes. Wind comes, they get destroyed. Space is unaffected. It is all what they say is a container of everything, yet contained in nothing. Space by itself, the absolute abstract space, is inconceivable. When we think of space, typically we see that space containing something or space extending a particular object to infinity. But space, abstract space, are we able to conceive it for a mind? No. So, we get some idea of nature of that one reality by this symbol of absolute abstract space. The other symbol we are told is the absolute abstract motion. We are told that this Parabrahma, one reality, in that arises periodically numberless universes. They come into existence and go out of existence, they get merged back into that one reality. You can think of waves arising on the surface of ocean. They arise and they subside. They arise and they subside. It's a cyclic process which is beginningless and endless. And this is indicating that this God, absolute God, is not inert. There is this motion aspect which is there. In Hinduism, they say it is a great breath. Our breathing comes, brings out universes, and with the infinity, they can absorb that into that reality. And whenever you see motion, a small insect moving, you can see there is a consciousness in it. Now, there must be therefore consciousness there in that reality. The universes come into existence and go out of existence. But this is not a finite consciousness. It is not a conditioned consciousness. Consciousness, which is absolute abstract consciousness. And it is not a consciousness that is the object and subject, perceiver and perceived. Because if we say it is all pervasive, infinite, then there is nothing outside of that one God for it to perceive, to be conscious about, or have any relationship whatsoever. one reality and you forgive us and you grant us the object of our desire. This is something which we need to understand. Now if this is the case, then the question arises, how is it then that many religions they are talking about multiplicity of God? When this idea, Hinduism speaks of 33 crores of gods and goddesses, and they say that forces and powers of nature are presided over by various gods. So they say there is a god of wind called Pavana, there is a god of fire called Agni, there is a god of rain called Varuna, and so on. They also speak of gods which preside over certain functions. So we are told that Yama is called god of death. He conducts the soul of the dead person. He passes judgment on him and conducts him to heaven or hell. And also there are Yipika, Chitragupta, a recording angel. He is having a function of making a meticulous record of all other beings, good, bad, and different. And it is based on this meticulous record that you are going to be judged. Also, some people say that God rules over certain regions. So Indra is said to be a god who rules over heaven world. He's called god of gods. So all the minor gods, Pandavas, Lakshas, the Asuras, they kind of serve Indra. And this sort of polytheistic idea of multiplicity of God is not just there in Hinduism. You find Egyptian people have also got numerous gods whom they pray. Each one will pray to their own separate god. So, how this idea of multiplicity of God has come into being? And we get an answer in the Bhagavad Gita, where Krishna points out about the transcendental aspect of one reality and an immanent aspect of one reality or God. In the 10th chapter of the Gita, he describes his divine excellencies. He shows, I am there as a Kamadevu, I am there as a Ganges, I am there as a Himalaya, and whatnot. But he says that all these are by way of example. He says that I am existing everywhere. And he says, bring out that transcendental aspect. See what he says in the quotation 1. He says, but what, O Arjuna, has thou to do with so much knowledge as this? I establish this whole universe with a single portion of myself and remain separate. So this is very clearly bringing out that in the manifested world there is that God very much present. There is an immanent aspect of God in the manifested world. But how does this one reality bring about this manifestation of the world? And how gods decide over various functions? For this we have to understand the first fundamental, which says that, as you said, with a great prayer, universes come into existence and go out of existence. But each universe is a continuation of the previous universe. It is a march which is onward and upward. Each universe takes the beings to a higher and higher realm, which has no limit. Perfectivity has no limit. In a particular universe, you may attain goals far and more further, but that process has no limit. And we are told that at the dawn of manifestation, the plan for the next universe is there in the divine mind. And it is this plan which is conceived by great beings. There are seven great beings that is talked about by various religious traditions. They say, they call them different, call them differently. They say there are Amsha Spectras, there are Sephiroths, there are Eons, there are Archangels, and Trolls. There are seven great beings. Are they gods? No. We are told that they were human beings like you and me. They undergoing the evolutionary process in prior periods of evolution and reach full enlightenment. And rather than enjoying the peace and bliss, they undertook that task of helping that God or the nature in working the work or bringing about the work of the God. So what they do, at the dawn of manifestation, says they see the plan of the divine mind, and this plan is an impressed on matter. And therefore, when the differentiation takes place, we have myriads of different beings, that all they work according to the plan, the purpose which is there in the divine mind. This is what is understood as the immanent aspect of nature of that God. And it is as for his plan, we are told, that from that trinity of spirit, matter, and power, or the seven beings, comes seven hierarchy of divine beings. On seven planes of matter, there is a variation of divine beings that come into existence during the entire period of manifestation. And so we are told that this universe is not running as science says, without any plan or purpose, blind forces of nature, guiding the universe as it pleases, certainly not. There is a purpose, planning. In the universe, law is working everywhere. Laws of science is very clearly showing. If there are laws of matter, there are laws of psychic world, there are laws of spiritual world. All they are there. And so Hindus are not wrongly saying that there is a God of fire, God of earth, God of ocean, God of wind. But they are not gods. They appear, these beings who have emanated from that highest being, lower beings who have come, they are not gods. They are also human beings, but they are on lower ranks. But they appear to us as gods, just as we would appear like gods to an ant. To an ant, person would appear like a god. A black people will consider us as gods. Just like that, we at our stage of development, to us, these beings, they appear to us as gods. But these beings, they help nature in the evolutionary task. They preside over various kingdoms of nature, guide the evolution from mineral kingdom to vegetable to animal to human kingdom and so on. We are told that there are beings who have given us our body. There are beings who have lighted up our mind. Mind was dormant, but they lighted up our mind by that light which was there already lighted up in their inner. They are the solar decrees and lunar decrees, again, which Hinduism talks about, and they revere them. And these great ones, we are told to take periodically. Whenever the law of karma permits, whenever the cycles permit, they assist in a very definite manner the evolutionary progress of mankind. And this is cyclically done. This is known as cycle of avatars. So you find that the entire collectivity of grand Brahmanic intelligence, all the seven great beings, focus their consciousness in a being of Krishna who was called the Purna avatar. Rama was called the partial avatar. And we know that there will be a tenth avatar called Sosho or what's called as Kalki avatar, which is talked about in Buddhism, which is talked about in Zoroastrianism, also which is talked about in Brahmanism and so on. And the purpose of this avatars is very beautifully put in Bhagavad Gita, which is there in your quotation too. That purpose is enumerated saying that I produce myself among creatures of Sanatarata whenever there is decline of virtue and an insurrection of vice and injustice in the world. And thus, I incarnate from age to age for preservation of the just, the destruction of the wicked, and the establishment of righteousness. And let us not think that we are primitive people born in sin. We have come from the same one reality. That same divine essence is very much there in us. And what
bought what other men have done. Anushasanta, Dhyanjohan, Sephiroth, we can reach that godlike stage. At this stage, we have forgotten our godlike nature because there is ignorance, because the form has not been purified. The mental apparatus, the physical apparatus, the spiritual apparatus requires discipline, purification. And it is then that we can re-become the God, or rather, we realize ourselves to be none other than God ourselves. See what Quotation 3 says of the whole of life. It says that the breath becomes a stone a plant an animal, the animal a man, the man a spirit, and the spirit a God. The mind consumes, the rishis, the builders, etc. are all men, of whatever form and shapes, in other worlds, and in receiving another us. So, God is not separate from us. We are very that God. Voice of the Silence beautifully says, look in world, thou art Buddha. It's not simple empty words. Bhagavad Gita, in more than one place, Krishna says, I am the ego situated in the hearts of all beings. At another place he says that there dwelling in the heart of every teacher, O Arjuna, Master Ishvara, the Godhead is there within us. And he also says that deluded people, they despise me in human form. When we see another person, we judge that person in terms of his qualifications, attributes, the height and the way he speaks, mannerisms, and at once we identify a lot of people respecting and despise people, but then God is there in that being. So Krishna says, will you then despise me in human form? Of course, it's a long, long way before we will realize our own godly nature. But for that we have to undertake spiritual discipline. We have to work as though we are God, and that same God is present in all creatures. Not only human beings, even in the lower kingdoms. We have to work in that way. And when we progress higher and higher, we have to come to a stage where a person reaches a great stage of purity. And at that stage, we are told that he can, just by a wish, he can say that I do not want any more struggles. I want to become Deva. No more I want to be tested. I have seen that purity is essential and I want to become Deva. He becomes a Deva. Of course, this is a high stage. When he becomes a Deva, from that point onwards, till eons of time, he enjoys the peace and bliss. No longer he is subject to the temptations to which ordinary human being is. And in that sense, Devahood is inferior to the perfected spiritual man. He has overcome the temptation, gone beyond that stage of Deva and attained to the highest enlightenment. Devas, they know that they enjoy that peace and bliss, but later on, they have to eventually, and in the next world, have to incarnate and begin their time, of course at a higher level as compared to the previous universe, but then they have to begin their time anew from the lowest rung. So this is something we need to remember. And also, now we can ask ourselves a question, that should we be then considering offering our prayers to that God? We saw there is this transcendental aspect of God, which is not a person, which has no relationship with a finite being. He listens not to our prayer because we are very much part of it. So it is futile to pray to that one absolute principle. And praying to the immanent aspect of God, the gods which are there in this manifested world, we know that they are nothing but the perfected beings who have reached that godlike state. But they are as much subject to the working of the karma, and they are not going to grant you anything that you have not really deserved as a result of your own discipline or offering or sacrifices. They will offer you and offering what you deserve, they work strictly within the framework of the law of Dharma. And therefore, Lord Buddha, in the light of Asia, says in the quotation 5, seek not from the heavenly gods by gifts and cream, nor bribe with blood, nor feed with fruit and dates. Within yourselves, deliverance must be sought. Each man is present in it. But still, there is some truth in the efficacy of prayer. But this prayer is explained by Plato as that meditation which is described as a silent and unuttered prayer. This prayer is not asking for any desire or particular good, but for the good itself, for the universal supreme good, and explaining to us how that ardent prayer becomes effective and the results come. It should be tells us in the Hindu philosophy that our finite and conditioned thoughts cannot be absorbed by the absolute spirit. They can get transformed into spiritual prayer or spiritual will. It becomes a philosopher's stone. And then we are told that that creative prayer or creative will brings about the results that you ardently desire. Your intense desire brings about results. But this is not the prayers that you utter with your words. This is the ardent turning of the soul to the divine within. But it should be wants us that all the man who uses this prayer for asking for something good for selfish purposes, she says that instead of asking for thy will be done, not mine, if you ask for something for yourself, then it is nothing else but black magic or sorcery. Now, we also see that we have in the history of mankind, sages, seers, high beings, they talk about coming face to face with the Lord, meeting the God, conversing with the Lord. Is it a figment of their imagination? Is it something which they are lying? They are pious and holy people. How do you understand that they have seen God, they have conversed with God? We know Moses, he conversed with Jehovah, who instructed him on the Mount Sinai and commandments were given. Abraham was called friend of God. He initiates from Egypt, they were also called friend of God. Arjuna had a fortune of seeing the Vishwarupa of Sri Krishna. How do we really understand this? Here we have to understand that the immanent aspect of God, the hierarchy of those great beings that we talked about earlier, those godlike beings, they can and do appear before man whenever the conditions permit in terms of the marriage of the individual. They can and do also grant the moon. I mean, Hindu mythology is full of these moons granted to various people who undertake great penances and so on. But we have to remember, those moons are granted because this person has deserved it with years of spiritual discipline, penances, by meditation, ascetic practices, and so on. And when these boons are granted, these devas or these gods, they do not violate the laws which are there in the universe. So you won't find them granting the good or boon of immortality. There is that story of Hiranyakashipu, the father of Prahlada, the Vaidya king. He wanted to become immortal, so he undertook severe penances. Finally, the God was very pleased with him and he said, okay, you ask for any boon that you like. So this Hiranyakashipu, knowing that it's not going to be granted immortality, he said, grant me a boon that I should not be killed by a man or an enemy. I should not be killed during day or night. I should not be killed in the house or outside the house. he was granted this book, but there was this catch there. Ultimately, this Hiranyakashipu was given by the Narasimha avatara of Vishnu, that is Narasimha, Narasimha, man, lion, avatar of Vishnu. So neither animal nor man, he was killed neither during day nor at night, but during twilight, thus evening. And he was killed not inside nor outside, but on the threshold of the doorway. All the conditions are fulfilled. Hiranyakashipu was killed. So you see that these human beings, they are very subject to the laws which are there. They do not violate the law. They are themselves embodiers of this law. And therefore, we are told that all worlds, right up to Brahma, are subject to karma. They have their beginning and an end. Each universe has got its own Ishvara. Ishvara, in Hindu philosophy, they say that it is Trinity of Brahma, Vishnu and Shiva. The power of creation, preservation and destruction. But when the universe undergoes dissolution, Ishvara merges back into that one absolute reality. This Ishvara, therefore, is finite. And there is very humorous kind of story to bring this out. One Brahma of a particular universe was feeling very proud of this universe that he had created. Brahma is supposed to be presiding over the creation of the world. So he was feeling very proud of his world, and he said, what a beautiful world I have created. I am supreme, there is no one like me. At that time, suddenly he found a row of camels going past his palace. One after the other, a camel was just going past his palace, and on the back of the camel was mounted a huge trunk. He was very curious, he went on looking and wondering, what is this big trunk containing? There was an animal. But on the last camel, there was a man, so he called out to him, hey, what are you carrying and where are all these animals going? What is there in this trunk? And this man said, oh, there is nothing. These camels are carrying trunks, and each of these trunks has got a Brahma for future universes which will come. Brahma began to realize that I am not the only one, there are as many Brahmas as there are universes, and only a finite being for this universe. This is kind of bringing out this aspect of finite aspect of God. Also, in the world, we do come across people who say that, particularly in India, you find they say that this or that person, God comes and takes possession of this person. And at that time, we say Devi Aka or Bhagwan Aka. And then people go at the feet of the person and ask all sorts of mundane questions, what will happen, what I should do for this, that, or the other question, and so on and so forth. Also, similar tradition existed in Christianity, or belief, rather not tradition, belief existed in Christianity and also in pagan worlds. They talk about the existence of guardian angel, familiar spirit, or daimon. And we are told that H.P. says that these daimon, familiar spirit, guardian angel, they are nothing but spirits, good or bad, human or otherwise, and more often they are the elemental spirits. And Socrates himself was having his own elemental spirit who warned him, based on which he would tell his disciples to do certain things, not to do certain things. Like H.P. says that do not consult this dialogue, familiar spirit, or daily or whatever which has come and possess this individual. Because if you continue to indulge in these practices, eventually you will fall into mediumistic practices. You will become medium. And such mediums are never initiated into higher mystery. Socrates was not initiated, and ultimately it is such practices which caused him his death. As it exists, there are beings who are absolutely pure, who have reached a very high stage, and with that purity, they can invoke the very highest the higher ego, the God within its own nature. And that mind is done. That is done by what is called the practice of theurgy. They can confabulate with their own God, which is present in each and every one of us. They confabulate with what is called as Ubayas, about which Apollo even speaks in his own. And at times, when the person reaches the highest stage of evolution, at the time of last initiation, he comes face to face with the Dhyani Buddha, who stands at the head of the hierarchy to which this person belongs. We are all emanations from this one or this other out of the seven hierarchies. When you reach that high stage, at the time of last initiation, you come face to face with this divine being. And this vision is absolutely pure, divine. But once it is passed, people are not able to describe that divine vision. And so typically, after the vision is passed, what they say is that I had seen this world. And their explanation or description is in terms of the idea of God that they had got from their vision. So Hindu person will speak about, they saw a God with four arms, with different beggars and so on, with some Buddhas and so on. Christian will typically say that I saw Jesus. Buddhist will say I saw Buddha. This is the highest vision that one can really have. But the ultimate is something which is explained later on, which will come to you. We realize therefore that all these great beings that we talk about, right up to the Dhyani Buddha, they are definitely working for the world, but for them the universe will perish. It is their sacrifice which keeps the world revolving, and we owe great reverence to them. But we should not be really praying and asking for personal good or personal benefit. We owe our reverence, and we can express their gratitude by offering sacrifices, not in terms of something in kind, but in contributing in the work of the world, doing whatever we can for the good of other beings. And when that is not done, we are told that these powers and potencies which preside over these forces, they depart. Gods depart to other spheres, and it happens during the time of the new one. Gods might have departed, so the right kind of food we do not get. And thus we realize that we do not have to look outside for God. We are ready for God. We have to work. Undertake spiritual discipline. We can become like Buddha, Jesus, Moses, Shankara, Mahavira. They are the shining examples for us to emulate. When we undertake that spiritual discipline, when we purify all our selfish nature and treat other beings as verily the Lord, walking on earth, then there comes a stage where we attain enlightenment, highest stage of samadhi, when no longer there is a feeling of me and other people different. You become one of the universe's close eye. So I have seen all this. Now it is up to us to decide in what way we want to approach God, and whether we approach the transcendental aspect or the immanent aspect. But it is up to us, with the help of those divine beings, what they have given to us time and again, in terms of the teaching scriptures, to follow that and try to realize that God within our own nature. Friends, we have about 2 minutes for taking up the questions.
One question. All elements are within space, and space is within all elements. Space is in our body, and body is within space. So space is infinite. How did space get the power to be infinite?
The question is that all the elements and beings that exist in space, space interpenetrates us, it is there in us, and yet it is infinite. How does the space come to possess this infinity? When is space? Is the question. Actually speaking, this space is a symbol or an aspect of what has gone beyond. That space is always existing. It is not that it was there and not going to be there later. Whether universes are there, but they are destroyed. The space is what we always need. We can understand that transcendental aspect of reality comes from spirit and matter. In the manifested world, there is spirit and matter, which are united by the intelligence which is called as one. And that space aspect we can think of in terms of the all-pervasive matter, which is also called Mulabhati in philosophy. It is aspect of that law, and so it is called pervasive. What is Jnani Buddha? It is a large question. We refer to this Jnani Buddha. Various names are there, Anushastaka, Jnani Buddha, Archangel, Leon, Sephiroth. They are the beings who have perfected themselves at the highest level of evolution that could be obtained in the previous period of Anantaras. And they remain behind to help humanity instead of getting into nirvana and enjoying peace and bliss. What happens? They then become the helpers of nature. And we are told that when the manifestation takes place, they become the cosmic mind. What happens? You have an idea in your mind. It requires brain to conceive in terms of words, and then pass the command so that it will be spoken in word. Like that, there is this idea of a universe to be there in the divine mind. Now that has to be interpreted by a brain-like vehicle instrument. That brain-like vehicle instrument is provided by these great beings who have reached the highest stage. They become the embodiment, place in the plant, and they become the cosmic mind. And they can impress this idea on matter according to which the matter behaves. So, fire will burn, water will wet, sun rises and sets, and so on and so forth. It is the order of the universe. It is because these ideas are taken and impressed on matter by these great beings. And you and I have the potentiality of reaching that higher stage. One day we can also become the great Jnani Buddha. Thanks for your time, sir.